You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Okay, so the book of 1 Samuel is one of the oldest books in the Bible. It's after the first five books and then a couple of history books. So this is about 1000 BC. This is a transition point in the history of Israel where they go from being kind of some scattered tribes, and by the end of this, they're going to be a unified nation under a king. But we're still in the middle of that transition where they're not quite sure what it looks like to follow God as a country, especially as they face opposition. In the first three chapters of Samuel, 1 Samuel, we saw the calling of Samuel, the author of this book, including his miraculous birth. But then as we get into chapters 4 through 6, he kind of disappears from the narrative. And we're going to see, you know, kind of one last episode where they're just sort of acting as tribes, and where God enters into that whole picture. So in 1 Samuel chapter 4, verse 1, it says, "Now the Israelites went out to fight against the Philistines." Okay, this was a people group that showed up once or twice in the book of Judges. If you know about Samson, the judge, he was battling against the Philistines. But it's important to understand who they are. So here's a map of kind of the southern part of Israel. You see the Dead Sea down there on the bottom. Here's Jerusalem right here. The Philistines really occupied these coastal areas. They were a seafaring people. So they had come from other islands and, you know, sea bordering areas of the Mediterranean. And they had ended up here in the Promised Land. They were technologically advanced compared to Israel. They had already gotten a hold of some of the iron tools that were available, whereas the Israelites were still in the Bronze Age. So they had way better weapons, which explains why they were constantly able to win in any of the battles that they had. They were perennial enemies in 1 Samuel. They were just kind of a thorn in Israel's side. Every time you turn around, the Philistines were doing something negative to one of the Israelite towns. And they really centered around five major cities. You know, the battles that they would get into with Israel, they were really just trying to capture people so that they could enslave them. That's what people and tribes did back then. And it didn't have an explicitly religious tone to it, but everything back then was religious. Because if two towns were battling against each other, then the god of this town was battling the god of that town. And of course, the Israelites knew there's only one God. And he's our God of all of our towns and villages. But the Philistines were not totally clear on that. And so we'll see how that plays out tonight. It says the Israelites were camping at Ebenezer and the Philistines at Aphek. So Ebenezer, we're not exactly sure where it is, but it's in this general area. So kind of the middle portion of Israel. And the Philistines are over here at Aphek or Aphek. And, you know, it's never good if your enemies are gathering at Aphek. So it says, the Philistines deployed their forces to meet Israel, and as the battle spread, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 of them on the battlefield. Okay, this number 4,000, it's a little bit disputed if you get into some of the commentaries, because it's just a Hebrew word, aleph, that could mean thousands, it could just mean groups. But either way, the point is, the Israelites lost. They lost the battle. And God, earlier in the Old Testament, promised, if you are faithful to me, I will make sure to protect you. So the fact that they lose this battle indicates that something is wrong in their relationship with God. And this is a really big deal for them. It says, when the soldiers returned to camp, the elders of Israel asked, why did the Lord bring defeat on us today before the Philistines? So they correctly are wondering, what is happening? Where did we go wrong in our relationship with God that he would allow this to happen? But notice, they ask the question, but they just kind of ask each other. At no point in this do they turn to God and ask, what went wrong? And where do we need to reconcile with you? Instead, they decide, let us bring the Ark of the Lord's Covenant from Shiloh so that he may go with us and save us from the hand of our enemies. Okay, Shiloh is this town over here. This is where the narrative was located last week. This is where the tabernacle was, the tent of meeting that God had commanded to be set up. This is where the priest Eli was with his sons, Hophni and Phinehas, who we found out were really bad dudes. They were using their religious power to take advantage of the people. But the tabernacle was there, and it had the Ark of the Lord's Covenant. And so before we go any further, it's important to understand what the Ark of the Lord's Covenant was. Okay, the tabernacle was a tent that God said, this is what you should build for me so I can symbolically dwell in your midst. Okay, we know that God doesn't really live in a tent. God is everywhere. But he's like, I want to communicate the desire to be with my people. You guys are living in tents. Just build me a tent too. And nobody was allowed in the tent except for the priests, the Levites. He wanted to teach them, you know, you can't just waltz into my presence because I am a perfect and holy God and you are imperfect people. And then in the very back of the tabernacle was the one room, the holiest of holies, and that's where the Ark of the Covenant was. And only one person could go into that room once a year, the high priest, and we'll talk about what it was that he would do when he would go in there. And again, the point was there needs to be a certain separation. So, zoom in on the Ark of the Covenant. I know, not my graphics, but really cool. When you look inside, there were three things that were supposed to be in the Ark of the Covenant. And we'll cover these very briefly. The first thing that they put in there was Aaron's staff, which had budded. There was a time in the exile when they were wandering in the wilderness where the Israelites were like, you know, you said that Moses and Aaron were supposed to lead us, but we're not sure that we want them as leaders anymore. We want to go our own way. We want to pick our own leaders. And then through a series of events, you know, they brought out the walking staffs of 12 different leaders. And God's like, leave them here before the tabernacle. And Aaron's staff the next day, a dead piece of wood, had, you know, grown branches and leaves and sprouted almond buds. And it was God's way of saying, I picked Aaron as my representative. So he is the leader that I want to lead. And you can't just reject my leadership whenever you want. So he's like, put that staff in the ark to remind yourselves of the times that you rejected my leadership. There was also a golden jar holding manna. Manna was the miraculous food that God had given the Israelites while they were in the desert. All they had to do was go outside of their tents and pick up this food, and then they could make the food that they needed for the rest of the day out of the manna. And, I mean, how easy is that, right? There's no grocery trips. There's no click list. You just walk outside, and the food's right there, and you pick it up. And what did the Israelites do? They were like, nah, we don't really like this manna. We wish we had something better. And God's like, you don't like what I'm providing for you. This incredibly easy, really healthy meal that you get every single day without doing anything for it. Why don't you put some of that manna in the ark to remind yourselves of every single time you've rejected my provision for you? And then the final thing that was in there was the tablets with the Ten Commandments, the two tablets with the Ten Commandments. And what these represented was God's character. It was really his way of saying, this is what I am like, and if you are going to be my people, this is what you need to be like. And when you read the Ten Commandments, they kind of look like pretty minimal requirements, like don't kill people and don't sleep around with other people's spouses. And yet, we as really fallen human beings are like, nah, we don't really like those standards. And who are you to judge us, God? And God's like, why don't you put the Ten Commandments in the ark as a reminder that you are rebelling against my character and my standard? So when you looked at the Ark of the Covenant, it was a reminder of how they rejected God's leadership, how they rejected God's provision, and how they rejected God's character and God's standards. Which, you know, there's a staff that budded and some manna. Feels a little weird. But when you think about it, you know, this represented their rebellion against God. And then over the top of it was supposed to be these two carved angels who were looking down all the time at the way that the people of God had rebelled against God. In a way of saying, God, what are these people that you are putting up with? Look at what they've done to you. And if you think about it, this ark really represents our heart, doesn't it? Rejecting God's leadership, rejecting God's provisions, rejecting God's character and God's standard. And it's not that big of a leap to realize that that's me. That's my heart in the ark. And if you're not sure, well, ask yourself, well, have you ever wanted to go your own way? I don't really want to do what God's asking me to do. I want to be the one to decide. Have you ever wanted to meet your own needs? God says, this is the way he's going to provide, but that's not really what I want, and honestly, I'm kind of unhappy with what it is that he's giving me, and I feel upset with him. Have you ever resented God for having a standard Who are you, God, to tell me that I'm wrong? So when we look at the ark, we realize he provided that picture for the Israelites, but the problem that they had is the same problem that we have today. So you look inside and you realize all of our failures, all of the ways that humanity has rejected God. And then it's like, well, that's a bummer, because that's really bad news if the ark represents our failures against God. Now, over the top of the ark was something called the mercy seat. There was a lid that was put over the top. And, you know, the angels, symbolically, because they were just carved angels, they were able to look through the lid. What was in there was in there. It wasn't hiding anything. But the reason they put a cover on it, when the high priest went into that holiest of holies once a year, what he was supposed to do was he was supposed to bring the blood of a lamb. What God said was, okay, you've rebelled against me, and you do deserve my judgment for that, but how about I provide a substitute for you? So once a year, on the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, they would slaughter an innocent lamb and take the blood of the lamb and put it on the mercy seat. And what that meant was, when the angels looked down, they no longer saw the symbols of rebellion inside. What they saw was the blood of the substitute, which meant these sins are no longer taken into account. Which is a great picture, but as much as what's inside the ark represents a reality, the picture of the lamb ended up being fulfilled in a greater reality, Jesus Christ himself. Now think about in the beginning of the Gospel of John, where Jesus starts his ministry, and John the Baptist looks at him and he says, that's the Lamb of God who's come to take away our sins. This whole picture was to say, we have rebelled against God, and God himself has provided the substitute, and he is the substitute. God the Son has come saying, you can have your blood be on that mercy seat. You can pay for your sins yourself, or you can allow my blood to be what covers that mercy seat. If you acknowledge that you've rebelled against me and you ask for my death to be what pays for your sins, then you pass out of judgment. So this is the Ark of the Covenant that they had, and they didn't fully understand everything. That was only going to be fulfilled in Jesus, but they knew this Ark of the Covenant is incredibly important and very, very central to the way that we are going to worship God. And what do they say? You know what? We just lost a battle. Let's go get that box and bring it with us, and maybe that will help us in our next battle. Remember, it was supposed to be in the tabernacle, in the Holy of Holies. Only one person was supposed to see it one day a year. And they're like, I don't know, let's bring it to the fight. And it says, so the people sent men to Shiloh, and they brought back the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, who's enthroned between the cherubim. Okay, how do you say this is a bad idea without saying this is a bad idea? The author says they went and got the Ark of the Covenant, which we just talked about how incredibly holy and significant that is. The Ark of the Covenant, which belongs to the Lord Almighty, the God of the universe, who's sitting on his throne between the cherubim, who are incredibly powerful angels. And the narrator's like, yeah, so they just went and got that. And it says, Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. All right, notice Samuel doesn't come. It's possible it's because he's too young. It's possible because he's like, this is a really bad idea, and this is not what we're supposed to do. But Hophni and Phinehas, who we saw last week, were not the least bit spiritual. We're like, you want the ark? We'll bring the ark. Okay, this is like, hey, everybody, we're going to Burning Man. And you know what we're bringing with us? We're bringing the Mona Lisa. This is going to be awesome. And you're like, this is not going to end well, is it? So what happens? When the Ark of the Lord's Covenant came into the camp, all Israel raised such a great shout that the ground shook. So they got really excited. Hearing the uproar, the Philistines asked, what's all this shouting in the Hebrew camp? So they're like a couple miles away, and the yelling is so loud that they can hear it from where they're at. When they learned that the Ark of the Lord had come into the camp, the Philistines were afraid. A God has come into the camp, they said. Oh no, nothing like this has happened before. We're doomed. Okay, a God did not actually come into the camp. Because God was like, look, I'm not in the ark. I'm not even in the tabernacle. All of this is symbolic. So on the one hand, you see the Philistines and their very limited picture of what a God is. On the other hand, you could see why they're getting that impression from the Israelites. The Israelites are kind of treating it like this is some sort of magic token that's going to help them in their battle. So they're not correcting these people's perspective at all. Philistines go on, who will deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? They are the gods who struck the Egyptians with all kind of plagues in the wilderness. What's interesting about that is the exodus from Egypt happened about 350 years before this battle. But the idea of slaves defeating the most powerful nation on earth at the time was so momentous that the story had made its way down, and they knew some of the details. They said, be strong, Philistines, be men, or you will be subject to the Hebrews as they have been to you. Be men and fight. Okay, so they obviously were enslaving the Hebrews. And they're like, if we lose, they're going to make us slaves. And we don't want the tables to be turned here. So the Philistines fought. And the Israelites were defeated. And every man fled to his tent. The slaughter was very great. Israel lost 30,000 foot soldiers. So way more than they did in the first battle. The Ark of God was captured. Okay, are we surprised by that? Again, let's go back to Burning Man. We're taking Mona Lisa. Okay, have you heard what happened at Burning Man this year? It's like, if you go there with something really valuable, that's not going to turn out well. So the author was kind of signaling, this is where it's heading. So the Ark of God is captured. And Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, died. So they lost their lives as the ark was being captured. So that same day, a Benjamite ran from the battle line and went to Shiloh with his clothes torn and dust on his head. When he arrived back in that town, there was Eli sitting on his chair by the side of the road watching because his heart feared for the ark of God. He probably knew it was not supposed to be taken into battle, but like we saw last week, he was too weak to stop his sons from taking it, but he was really worried what was going to happen. When the man entered the town and told what had happened, the whole town sent up a cry. Eli heard the outcry and asked, "What is the meaning of this uproar?" The man hurried over to Eli, who was 98 years old and whose eyes had failed so he couldn't see. So the man shows up with dust on his head and his clothes torn. That's a symbol of mourning, but Eli couldn't see that. He just heard everybody wailing. He didn't know what had happened yet. And he told Eli, "I've just come from the battle line. I fled from it this very day." Eli asked, "What happened, my son?" The man who brought the news replied, "Israel fled before the Philistines, and the army has suffered heavy losses. Also, your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead. And the Ark of God has been captured." Honestly, he kind of gives the news in order of how tragic it would be for Eli. It says, when he mentioned the Ark of God, Eli fell backward off his chair by the side of the gate. His neck was broken and he died. For he was an old man and he was heavy. He had led Israel 40 years. So he just falls over and breaks his neck and dies. I mean, to be fair, if he was 98, people are like, how did he die? And I was like, well, he was 98. But this is the leader of Israel who just fell and suddenly died in this news. And if that weren't sad enough, it says his daughter-in-law, the wife of Phinehas, was pregnant and near the time of delivery. When she heard the news that the Ark of God had been captured and that her father-in-law and her husband were dead, she went into labor and gave birth, but was overcome by her labor pains. As she was dying, the women attending her said, "Don't despair, you've given birth to a son." But she didn't respond or pay any attention. She named the boy Ichabod, saying, "The glory has departed from Israel because of the capture of the Ark of God and the deaths of her father-in-law and her husband." She said, "The glory has departed from Israel, for the Ark of God has been captured." So we end 1 Samuel 4 in an unexpectedly tragic situation. You know, they had been through some ups and downs as a people. You know, if you read about Joshua, there were some ups and downs. If you read about in the book of Judges, it's mostly downs. But the Ark of God had never been captured. And if the Ark was symbolic of God's relationship with his people, now it's gone. And the people in Israel are thinking, has God deserted us? Things are completely out of control. We thought that God was the God of the whole world, and he just lost, and he got captured. So is this God that we're following actually in control? Is he really able to do what he says he's able to do? Is he really the only God? Because the Philistines just won. And if we ended here at chapter 4, it would be, well, I don't know. Is God powerful or not? But we're going to continue on because that's not where the story ends. And the story itself is going to show us exactly what God is like. So we get to 1 Samuel 5, verse 1, and it says, after the Philistines had captured the Ark of God, they took it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Okay, so they're up here in Ebenezer, and they take it all the way down to their city in Ashdod. It says, then they carried the Ark into Dagon's temple and set it beside Dagon. Dagon was the god that they worshipped. He was some sort of fish god, we think, also a god of corn. This picture is from Mermaid Wikipedia, which apparently is a thing. And so they bring the Ark in, and they set it next to Dagon. What they're really saying by doing that is, our God beat your God, and we are here to make sure that everybody knows that we're the ones that won and that you are completely humiliated, which perhaps sounds a little bit familiar to any of us who are in any sort of competition. All right, what's tonight? It's the start of the NFL season, right? So I'm sure none of you are checking your sleeper app right now, making sure that your lineups are set. If you're in a fantasy league, what do you want to do? You want to win your league. There's a certain amount of glory that goes with winning your league. Soft flex, I know. I won my league last year. But what you really want to do is avoid the humiliation of losing, especially if you're in a league with consequences. My husband is terrified right now because he just joined a league with pretty significant consequences. He was at a draft party this week that was funded by the loser last year, who raised money by standing on a street corner playing a recorder until he hit a certain dollar amount. And that's mild compared to what the consequences are for this year. And I'm going to capture this on film if it happens. If my husband loses, or anybody who loses, but I really hope my husband loses. He's not here tonight, so I can say that. He needs to procure a colonial outfit, go to the OSU student involvement fair, and gain a certain number of signatures trying to get Vermont expunged from the union. This is a very creative league. Sorry, Vermont, nothing personal. Okay, so this is what is happening with Dagon, right? He's like, you lost, you are humiliated, and I'm going to make sure that everybody knows it. I mean, part of what they really think that Dagon's saying is, you silly, ignorant people thinking that God will take care of you. You trusted God, and it didn't work out, did it? Which, you ever hear that idea just kind of floating out there in the air? Okay, you're going to follow God, and you think that's going to work out for you? You're going to trust God, and you're not going to, you know, sell your soul to your professors to try to get the best possible grades, and you think you're going to end up with a good degree and a good career. You're going to trust God by not going for the first person who comes along who wants to date you, whether they're interested in God or not, and you think that's going to work out for you. You're going to trust God by setting up time boundaries so you can actually make it to times where you can sit under the word and fellowship with the people of God, and you think that's going to be good for your life. And it's like, oh, yeah, I guess people have been saying the same thing about anybody trying to follow God for thousands of years now. In fact, the wisest man that ever lived, Solomon, said, you know, history merely repeats itself. It's all been done before. Nothing under the sun is truly new. So this is the accusation that anybody trying to follow God has been facing since time immemorial. And what happens? Well, the people of Ashdod rose early the next morning. There was Dagon fallen on his face on the ground before the ark of the Lord. And they're like, hey, little ark, you're here to worship Dagon. And God's like, really? Dagon's on his face before my ark. Huh, isn't that interesting? What happens? Well, the people are like, oh, that's embarrassing. We need to fix that. So it says they put Dagon and they put him back up in his place. They're like, here, great God, let us set you back up so we can worship you again. Let me help you. Maybe it's something wrong with the stand, or maybe there was a weird earthquake that nobody else heard. And God's like, really? But the following morning when they rose, there was Dagon fallen on his face before the ground, before the ark of the Lord. And this time his head and his hands had been broken off and were lying on the threshold. Only his body remained. Not a coincidence. It says the Lord's hand was heavy on the people of Ashdod and its vicinity. He brought devastation on them and afflicted them with tumors. Okay, this word tumors, if you read maybe an old King James version, it translates it as hemorrhoids. Okay, that's not actually what it is, so you don't need to read it that way. But now if you're like me, you can't read it any other way. But brought devastation on them and afflicted them with tumors. He allowed a sickness to come into Ashdod, which sounds pretty serious. What we see here is that God is trying to get their attention. He's allowing things to happen. And we're going to see that it gets progressively worse, that it gets to a certain point where people actually start to die of this plague, which raises the question, is this fair that God would use something like sickness and death to get people's attention? So we want to spend just a minute thinking about God's hand upon the Philistines. And a few points to consider. One is that God actually wants people to turn to him. He doesn't enjoy when people suffer. You know, in the book of Ezekiel, God himself says, as surely as I live, I take no pleasure in the death of the wicked people. I only want them to turn from their wicked ways so they can live. Turn. Turn from your wickedness, O people of Israel. Why should you die? So when suffering happens, part of it is God trying to get our attention because he loves us. It's also just true that loss of health and physical life happens to everyone at some point. You know, if we're eternal beings, like the Bible says that we are, whether my life ends at 40 or at 80, in comparison to eternity, it kind of doesn't matter that much when you think of it from that perspective. That's something we all have to face. Also, they saw it as God punishing them. He could have just been allowing this plague to come in. You think about the hygiene laws that he set up for Israel, a certain amount of cleanliness to make sure that rats didn't overtake their cities, which is where these plagues came from. And also, if somebody got sick in the nation of Israel, he had very strict quarantine laws to make sure if one person got sick, it didn't get the whole town sick. And the Philistines had access to these laws if they wanted them, but they were like, no, we're good. We don't need any of your help. Thank you very much. What it comes down to is that God uses suffering to try to persuade people that life without him doesn't work. They thought, God of Israel, whatever, who cares? And he's like, look, if you try to do that, it doesn't matter how you try to take care of yourselves. You're not actually capable of even preventing a plague. So how about you turn to me instead? So let's see if they do. It says, when the people of Ashdod saw what was happening, they said, the ark of the God of Israel must not stay here with us because his hand is heavy on us and on Dagon, our God. Like, he keeps falling over. So they called together all the rulers of the Philistines and asked them, what should we do with the ark of the God of Israel? They answered, have the ark of the God of Israel moved to Gath. So they moved the ark of the God of Israel. So it was down here in Ashdod, and they sent it down to Gath. So they're like, I don't know, maybe it's a slightly different God in the area of Gath. Maybe he can deal with this God and his ark. It says, but after they had moved it, the Lord's hand was against that city, throwing it into a great panic. He afflicted the people of the city, both young and old, with an outbreak of tumors. So they sent the ark of God to Ekron. This is like ark hot potato at this point. They're like, well, that didn't work. So we were at Ashdod and then Gath, and what if we go up to Ekron? As the ark of God was entering Ekron, the people of Ekron cried out, they've brought the ark of the God of Israel around to us to kill us and our people. So they're like, why did you send it here? We don't want it. So they called together all the rulers of the Philistines and said, send the ark of the God of Israel away. Let it go back to its own place or it will kill us and our people. So they're realizing, okay, there's something here that we don't know what to do with and we have no control of. So can we just get it to go away, please? Because we don't want to face any of this. For death had filled the city with panic. God's hand was very heavy on it. Those who did not die were afflicted with tumors, and the outcry of the city went up to heaven. So some people were losing their lives. Now, one final point on this is if any of those people had turned to God at any point, even in the last moment of their life, if they had turned to God and acknowledged, my way's not working, I want to go your way, those people would have gone straight to heaven. So this is not God judging the bad people and protecting the good people. Anyone who wants to turn to God is going to be welcomed by him. But they were suffering as a result of this plague. So we get to 1 Samuel 6. It says, when the ark of the Lord had been in Philistine territory 7 months, the Philistine called for the priests and the diviners. So they knew it wasn't working, but they kept trying to make it work because they kept hoping maybe we can figure out a way to get this God under control. But finally, they call for their priests and their diviners. These were their magic workers. These were the people who were going to try to, you know, read the tarot cards, see what the crystals had to say, to figure out, what do we need to do here? And they asked, well, what should we do with the Ark of the Lord? Tell us how we should send it back to its place. They answered, if you return the Ark of the God of Israel, do not send it back to him without a gift. By all means, send a guilt offering to him, then you'll be healed, and you will know why his hand has not been lifted from you. Interesting that they said you should send a guilt offering. They seemed to sense, we've offended this God, and we need to make things right. Does that mean that they are softening and they're turning to God? Well, I think as we read the narrative, we'll find the answer to that. The Philistines asked, well, what guilt offering should we send to him? And they came up with 5 gold tumors and 5 gold rats. Make models of the tumors and of the rats that are destroying the country and give glory to Israel's God. So he's like, the rats have been spreading the plagues have led to tumors. So tell you what, let's make models of the tumors and the rats, cover them with gold, and we'll send that back. And God's like, awesome. Tumors and rats, just what I wanted. He makes it really clear, rats are nasty. And I mean, who wants a tumor? That's just not a good gift. So this is what they come up with that they're going to appease God with. Perhaps he'll lift his hand from you and your gods and your land. Why do you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh did? When Israel's God dealt harshly with them, did they not send the Israelites out so they could go on their way? This right here tells us the Philistines were being really stubborn. And they're like, you know, this Israel God, whatever. We want to figure out a way to make it work without him. And the priests and the diviners are like, well, then let's just get him as far away from us as we can. So they said, okay, here's our plan. Get a new cart ready with 2 cows that have calved, so they have 2 little baby calves, and have never been yoked. Hitch the cows to the cart, but take their calves away and pen them up. So essentially, this plan is like doomed to failure. Because you know what happens when you put a yoke on a cow for the first time? It freaks out. So they'll like take 2 cows that have never had a yoke before, put both of them in the yoke at the same time. Which if 2 cows who have never had the yoke before get put in the same yoke, they're going to go in 4 different directions at once. Not only that, but make sure they have little baby cows that as they're freaking out about the yoke, the little baby cows are also freaking out about the fact that mama's walking away from them. And this will be what's going to pull the cart. And then on that cart, we're going to take the Ark of the Lord and put it on the cart. And in a chest beside it, put the gold objects you are sending back to him as a guilt offering. Send it on its way. How is that going to work? They said, but keep watching it. If it goes up to its own territory toward Beth Shemesh, then the Lord has brought this great disaster on us. But if it doesn't, then we will know that it was not his hand that struck us, but that it happened to us by chance. So they're like, how about we come up with a plan that's doomed to failure? And if it doesn't work, it turns out that none of this was from God anyway. Which, again, I see myself in this narrative. Tragedy strikes, and I'm like, why, God, why? And then as soon as things clear up, I'm like, oh, well, guess it was nothing. What they want to do is go right back to what they were doing before and just ignore the things that God was trying to teach them. Because as soon as the plagues lift, then whatever, I don't know what that was. Let's just forget. Let's move on. Let's pretend that never happened. It was all just a coincidence. So they did this. They took two such cows and hitched them to the cart and penned up their calves. They're like, this is a great plan. And what happens? They place the Ark of the Lord on the cart. And, you know, they're little rats and tumors. So the cows went straight up toward Beth Shemesh, keeping on the road and lowing all the way. They did not turn to the right or to the left. So these two cows, who have never pulled a cart ever and are leaving their babies behind, walk in a straight line from Ekron to Beth Shemesh, protesting the entire time the fact that they were mooing the whole way down the road. But they go right to where the Philistines thought that they should go. So they're here at Ekron. They go all the way down to Beth Shemesh. That's like 30 miles away. The rulers of the Philistines followed them as far as the border of Beth Shemesh. You wonder if the whole time they're hoping, okay, when do they start to freak out? When does this plan fall apart? And the cows just keep going. And they don't stop until they get to an Israelite town. It says, now the people of Beth Shemesh were harvesting their wheat in the valley. And when they looked up and saw the ark, they rejoiced at the sight. All right, they got some warning it was coming because the two cows were mooing like crazy. And they hear this weird noise and they look up and there's the Ark of the Covenant. The big golden box that they were just devastated by losing. And then all of a sudden, it's back. Just like that. Without them really doing anything to try to get it back. It says, the cart came to the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh, and there it stopped beside a large rock. The people chopped up the wood of the cart and sacrificed the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord. Remember, the Philistine rulers were following them. You wonder if they were like, well, we were hoping to get those cows back. It's okay. You can have them. You can keep them. Enjoy the barbecue. It says, the Levites took down the Ark of the Lord together with the chest containing the gold objects and placed them on the large rock out in view of everybody so they could see the Ark of the Covenant. On that day, the people of Beth Shemesh offered burnt offerings and made sacrifices to the Lord. The five rulers of the Philistines saw all this and then returned that same day to Ekron. So they're like, well, at least we dealt with that problem. Let's go home. And they continue to be enemies of the Israelites for the next couple of decades. The large rock on which the Levites set the Ark of the Lord is a witness to this day in the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh. It's interesting, if you go to Israel, you can go to this valley. There's a road that runs right down the valley. Most of the roads in Israel follow old trade routes that have existed for millennia. The large rock isn't there, but, you know, there's lots of rocks in Israel, so it's hard to tell which one. This is a real historical place. And this is a great story about God miraculously working things out to prove that he had a plan the entire time. But it says God struck down some of the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh, putting 70 of them to death because they looked into the Ark of the Lord. The people mourned because of the heavy blow the Lord had dealt them. And we're like, this was a really nice story. And then you had to follow up with this. It actually makes sense, though, because he made it very, very, very clear through his word. That Ark is a very holy thing, and it needs to be treated with a lot of respect. Remember, tabernacle? One person, one day a year, and instead they've got it set up on a big rock so everybody can look at it. These were Levites too. They should have known better. And so God was like, all right, we said it was a capital offense to treat my ark with lack of respect. You guys knew that. And so he took 70 of them straight to heaven. He will do that sometimes in the Old Testament to communicate this is really serious. So on the one hand, kind of shocking. On the other hand, we see, you know, there were ways he moved against the Philistines. There were also ways he moved against the Israelites. So it's not like God was the God of the Israelites and he was playing favorites. He was like, look, I have standards. In fact, he was really gentle in some ways with the Philistines because there were things they didn't know, whereas the standards for the Israelites were higher, and he was willing to hold them to that. So the people of Beth-Shemesh asked, who can stand in the presence of the Lord, this holy God? Okay, the correct answer to that question is no one. No one can stand in the presence of the Lord. But then they asked, to whom will the ark go up from here? So they're like, oh boy, the ark came to us. We need to get rid of it. It's like, yeah, we've seen that before in this narrative. So they sent messengers to the people of Kiriath-Jearim saying, the Philistines have returned the ark of the Lord. Come down and take it up to your town. So they're like, we also need to get rid of this because we're not sure what to do with it. So they were there at Beth-Shemesh down at the bottom, and they sent the ark up to Kiriath-Jearim right at the top of that little road right there, right at that juncture. And it tells us in these last couple verses, so the men of Kiriath-Jearim came and took up the ark of the Lord. They brought it to Abinadab's house on the hill and consecrated Eleazar, his son, to guard the ark of the Lord. So the ark remained at Kiriath-Jearim a long time, 20 years ago. Nobody knows quite what to do with it. We think that the tabernacle was destroyed in that battle, so they just needed a place to put it. And it'll be there for a while until God starts to move again as he moves into the next phase of his plan. So 1 Samuel 4 through 6, what do we learn tonight? Well, one thing that comes across in this narrative is that God is always in control, even when it doesn't seem like it. And really, the times that we despair the most is just because we haven't waited long enough to see how God is going to work things out. So part of a position of faith is, I don't know what's happening right now, but I'm not going to draw the conclusion that you are any different than you say you are, God. If you say that you are the God of everything and that you always have a plan, it doesn't matter what the circumstances look like right now. It could be pretty bleak. But God's not worried about the day-to-day circumstances. He knows the entire picture, and he'll allow us to draw the wrong conclusions, but then he'll surprise us in the end. Whether it's in this life or the next life, he's going to show us exactly what it was that he was working out. God doesn't want anyone to perish, but for all to come to eternal life. He was trying to reach out to those Philistines just as he was trying to correct the Israelites, because he wanted them to see, if you would come under my protection, then there's a, you know, it's not that suffering ends in people's lives at that point, but it's a different kind of suffering, because we know it's something that God is specifically using for good in our lives. So he'll allow us to go through hard times in the hopes that we'll see our need for him and we'll turn to him. And so one question is, will you allow suffering to bring you back to God? If you're going through a hard time and you feel a distance, it's not because God has changed. It's because he's trying to draw you closer to him so you can experience him. And then the ultimate question, if you have not made that first decision to receive Christ's forgiveness, that's the most important question that he puts before everyone is, will you let Jesus be your sacrifice? Will you allow his blood to cover that symbolic mercy seat for you? And then once we are in a relationship with God through his son, Jesus Christ, then we start to see things from his perspective. We start to understand what it is that he's trying to accomplish in our lives and through the lives of people around us. And we can go through confusing and hard times with an attitude of trust that at the end of it, we're going to see things about God that are surprising and unexpected. Lord, I'm grateful that your plan is infinitely bigger than anything that I could ever hope to understand. But at the same time, you give us glimpses into how it is that you work, how it is that you try to draw people to yourself. And there are so many times, Lord, where I feel like things are completely out of control. And it's just doom and gloom, and I wonder how anything good could ever come out of it. And you take the long view on things. You see ways in which you are going to reveal yourself as far more powerful and far more good than we could ever possibly expect. And so, Lord, I don't like that you have to use suffering to draw me to yourself, but I'm certainly stubborn enough to need that. So thanks that you allow painful things to happen in the hopes that people will turn to you. But thanks, too, that you look into our hearts, you see the rebellion there, and you are the one that provided the means to pay for that. Thanks that your son came and paid that ultimate sacrifice. Thanks that his blood is what covers that so that we can be seen as you see him. And I pray, Lord, that that would give us confidence to really trust you and entrust our lives to you. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.